Remember the swine flu scare of 1976? That was the year the U.S. government told us all that swine flu could turn out to be a killer that could spread across the nation. And Washington decided that every man, woman, and child in the nation should get a shot to prevent a nationwide outbreak, a pandemic.
Dr. David Sensor, then head of the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, is now in private industry. He devised the swine flu program, and he pushed it.
You began to give flu shots to the American people in October of 76.
October 1st.
By that time, how many cases of swine flu around the world had been reported?
There had been several reported, but none confirmed.
Where did this so-called deadly variety of flu, where did it first hit back in 1976? It began right here at Fort Dix in New Jersey in January of that year when a number of recruits began to complain of respiratory ailments, something like the common cold.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant, independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Sunday, September 6, 2020. Thank you for joining me today. I have a very important show for you today. And this is actually, I wasn't planning on doing a show today. And this, I just had to bring to you. And it will most likely be a quick show, or at least as long as it takes to go over this one topic. And you know, that sometimes can take longer than we expect. But this is profound. This is a really important point in this discussion. And I'm really going to do my best to just let the information speak for itself. So let's get right to this. And I want to begin with the study itself. And this is a really important discussion here that I want everyone to kind of do their best to put aside what they may have thought beforehand to so we cannot allow that to get in and get muddled with what we're dealing with and the information we're staring at today. So without further ado, let's get to the information. The study that is actually has been out for longer than you might expect. This is entitled Public Health Lessons Learned from Biases in Coronavirus Mortality Overestimation. This is on Cambridge University Press, Disaster Medicine and Public Health Preparedness. Now, this is just the abstract. Now, it reads, now I have the highlighted part that is the most important, but I'm going to read the whole thing for you. Now, we're going to go through the whole thing for the most important parts that hopefully, nonetheless, you'll still read in its entirety, and as well as an article that came out that is discussing it that gives it a little more texture. But here we go. In testimony before U.S. Congress on March 11, 2020, members of the House Oversight and Reform Committee were informed that estimated mortality for the novel coronavirus was 10 times higher than for seasonal influenza. Additional evidence, however, suggests the validity of this estimation could benefit from vetting for biases and miscalculations. The main objective of this article is to critically appraise the coronavirus mortality estimation presented to Congress. Informational texts from the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are compared with coronavirus mortality calculations in congressional testimony. This is important. Results of this critical appraisal reveal information bias and selection bias in coronavirus mortality overestimation, the numbers, and most likely caused by misclassifying an influenza infection fatality rate as a case fatality rate. Now, if that doesn't make sense to you, it will. We'll go through it more. Public health lessons learned for future infectious disease pandemics include safeguarding against research biases that may underestimate or overestimate an associated risk of disease and mortality, reassessing the ethics of fear-based public health campaigns, which is a very well-documented thing that they discussed doing, and it says, and providing full public disclosure of adverse effects from severe mitigation measures to contain viral transmission. Discussing, so public health lessons learned from what they're discussing here. And this is just the abstract, is they're saying that we've basically learned that the reactions of our government were bad, that they caused problems, the severe mitigation measures to contain viral transmission and the adverse effects from it. And it's very clearly documented in this study. Now, again, to be clear, as always on this show, this is just one study. It's peer-reviewed. That's very, you know, a very respected side. The point is just it's one study. So take it in to digest it. But understand, we hadn't actually talked about this yet on the show, but there is another study that just came out of California that is saying the same ultimate thing, that it's been wildly overestimated. So this seems to be coming out in more ways than one. And I'll probably touch on the California study, which I only just saw the other day in a different show, because this is only what we're focusing on today. Now, this is just the abstract. Now, before I go into the actual article itself, or rather the study in its entirety, I wanted to go over something that somebody posted on Reddit that I thought was very interesting. Now, this is on a subreddit in Reddit. They're talking about, they just posted the study that we just went over, the abstract anyway. And all he says is, good post. Although it won't be well received now, which I argue it won't for, you know, on either side for a whole bunch of reasons. He says, this is essential reading for anyone, which we're going to go over, who is interested in understanding why government responded the way they did. You can read this and still agree the actions were appropriate, in parentheses or not. Either way, it is an excellent plain English breakdown of the data, assumptions, and events which got us from January to September 2020. Now, what he's saying there is, I take it, is that you on either side of this, like on from even a side of the people that agree with the lockdowns and agree with the government and the actions they took, they can point to this and say, see, the government did what they thought was right. And it was the experts who made a mistake. And we'll get into what that really was in the article. It breaks down to a basic math calculation error. That's what the study ultimately finds. So they could argue essentially that the government, acting in good faith, which I don't think is what happened, just took the numbers from the experts, and we ended up here. And so you're going to hold someone accountable, but it won't be the government as usual. I argue that there's more than one thing going on here, and this will flesh out as we go forward. But the point being that the government either ultimately created a situation to be able to do this, or recognized in the middle of something that they would be able to utilize it and have yet to let go, despite recognizing it wasn't there. Now, I think you know where my opinion lands in there, but nonetheless, it's interesting that you could see it this way. And adversely, on the other side of it, you could argue that this was ridiculous, that they just took this at face value and ran with it, which destroyed everything on this now clearly shown to be inaccurate assessment of what was going to happen. Now, here is the study itself. And the abstract we just read is right there. I believe I just screwed up something that I had highlighted, but we'll figure it out as we go along. Now, the introduction is where I'm going to begin. Now, again, as I said, I'm going to go through this. I'm going to point some things out, but I just want you guys to hear what this is trying to say and understand the breakdown. And we'll finish with something that might make it a little more clear. On September 23rd, 1998... the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, permanently lost contact with the $125 million Mars Climate Orbiter. A simple miscalculation, failure to convert English measurements to metric measurements, doomed the Mars space mission. Making an example, essentially, that people, even these kind of experts, can make a simple mathematical error. Of course, you know, this is making the argument that what happened with COVID-19 was an accident. And it could have been to begin with. Nonetheless, I think even if that's the case, we can clearly see that they have not, even the fact that, again, I think I forgot to make this point, which was great when I first showed you this, that'll blow your mind, is that this study came out on August 12th, and yet we have yet to hear about it. Think about how crazy that is. I mean, that is mind-blowing that this kind of assessment can come out from Cambridge, and it's August 12th, and we haven't heard a peep about this. All we've heard is more, fear, fear, danger, it's getting worse. Knowing that they're using this faulty information. But the argument is that even at NASA, they could make this mathematical error, a simple miscalculation. A later investigation found that backup quality assurance procedures were not in place at NASA to catch and correct that simple miscalculation. Fast forward 22 years to another crisis involving a U.S. government agency. On March 11th, 2020, the U.S. Congress House Oversight and Reform Committee received information from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, concerning the novel coronavirus, severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2, SARS-CoV-2, and coronavirus disease 2019, COVID-19, based on the data available at the time. Congress was informed that the estimated mortality rate for the coronavirus was 10 times higher than for seasonal influenza, which helped launch a campaign of social distancing, organizational and business lockdowns, and shelter-in-place orders. Previous to the congressional hearing, a less severe estimation of coronavirus mortality appeared in a February 28, 2020 editorial released by NIAID and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Published online in the New England Journal of Medicine, the editorial stated, "The overall clinical consequences of COVID-19 may ultimately be more akin to those of a severe seasonal influenza, which has caused a fatality rate of approximately 0.1%. And remember, we talked about this at the time. Almost a parenthetical afterthought, the NEJM editorial inaccurately stated that 0.1% is the approximate case fatality rate of seasonal influenza. By contrast, the World Health Organization reported that 0.1% or lower is the approximate influenza infection rate, not the case fatality rate. To fully appreciate the significance of the discrepancies in fatality rate usage by NIAID, the CDC, and the World Health Organization, brief definitions of relevant epidemiological terms follow." Now, it gets into the idea of case fatality rates. And I want to jump over here just for a moment. And this is the article we're going to get to in a moment. This is from RT, which is the reason it's important to focus on the study is because of people's political perceptions. And just because it's being read through something like this, even within Fox and CNN, people on the left will hate that, oh, I can't read something from Fox, and they'll just refuse to acknowledge anything that's in there, despite the fact that the links go to the study and so on. But nonetheless, it's an excellent article, and it's actually written by Malcolm Kendrick, a doctor and author who works as a GP for the National Health Service in England. So, you know, someone who has a right to speak on such things. It says, the 1% blunder, how a simple but fatal math mistake by U.S. COVID-19 experts caused the world to panic and order lockdowns. You know, or something that they made happen in order to make this all go the way, you know, or that's something we have to ask as possible. And I am very clear on the fact that that's something that could be possible in, with the people we're dealing with here. But it says, when you strip everything else out, the reason for the lockdown comes from a single figure, 1%. This was the prediction that COVID, if left unchecked, would kill around 1% of us. Now it says, first, and this is important, this is what the study is getting into. There's the infection fatality rate, the IFR, which is the total number of people who are infected by a disease and the number of them who die. This figure includes, and this sounds confusing, and this was confusing when I first read it, but go through both of these. This figure includes those who have no symptoms at all or very mild symptoms, those who stayed at home, coughed a bit, you know, and watched outbreak. Then there's the case fatality rate, the CFR. This is the number of people suffering serious symptoms who are probably ill enough to be in a hospital. Clearly, people who are seriously ill, the quote cases, are going to have a higher mortality rate than those who are infected, many of whom don't have symptoms. Put simply, this is important, all cases are infections, but not all infections are cases. So basically it says, which means the CFR will always be far higher than the IFR. With influenza, the CFR is about 10 times higher as the IFR, because the CFR being 10 times higher than the IFR, the IFR includes a lot of infections that aren't necessarily people who are symptomatic or transmissible and so on, right? So that the bottom line is that it can be way bigger. And if you confuse those two things, it can be catastrophic, which we are experiencing. It says the air started in America, but didn't end there. Now it says I'll come back to that actually in a moment, but this was important because I wanted to skip past the way that they were going over this, just because it was much more clear on that article. Now it says, it says, because different types of fatality rates can vary widely, it is imperative to not confuse fatality rates with one another, else misleading calculations with significant consequences could result, which is what this whole thing is about. Interestingly, a search of the keyword term infection fatality rate on the CDC website returned no matching results, nor was the epidemiological term located in a 511-page CDC publication, Principles of Epidemiology in Public Health Practice. This terminology omission, in conjunction with questionable use of fatality rate terminology in the NEJM, New England Journal of Medicine editorial, raises red flags, warning of possible inaccuracies in the coronavirus mortality estimation presented to Congress. similar to the need to vet for miscalculations that might have rescued NASA's 1988 Mars mission, vetting the coronavirus mortality estimation for miscalculations and biases may benefit the validity of mortality conclusions. Therefore, the purpose of this article is to present an ad hoc critical appraisal of the coronavirus mortality estimation presented to U.S. Congress on March 11th, 2020. Now, it's incredible to me, and this is what these studies always do, and fair enough, it's you err on the side of, you know, you don't have enough to point to one person directly. The bottom line is, it's almost incredible to me that we can't see how there's no way every part of that can be just oops. All of us, you know, that every single step of this is a complete oopsie. We just miscalculation, yes, but up until now, and still, I mean, the obvious point again, and this whole point, the whole discussion today, we should think about this, that this was published on August 12th. And nobody's talking about it. So that's almost confirms itself that they do not want to admit that this is a real catastrophic mistake, or obviously don't want us to see that this wasn't something that was calculated. However you want to look at it, that they're hiding it from you. And that's absolutely incredible. Jumping to discussion. Confusion between case fatality rates and infection fatality rates may seem trivial, and it is easy to overlook at first. But this confusion may have ultimately led to the unintentional miscalculation in coronavirus mortality estimation. Again, always erring on, you know, that it was an accident. It just makes me laugh. I can't even help it. But, an entire institution-wide, from top to bottom, from media and experts they bring on, that all of this was just missed. But it says IFRs from samples across the population include undiagnosed, asymptomatic, and mild infections, and are often lower compared to CFRs, which are based exclusively on relatively smaller groups of moderately to severe ill-diagnosed cases at the beginning of an outbreak. Due to host defense mechanisms and an autoimmunity provided by innate and adaptive immune responses, asymptomatic infections are often prevalent in influenza. With many asymptomatic infections already identified in COVID-19, it appears unlikely that the IFR in an influenza-like illness like COVID-19 would approximate the disease's CFR. Pre-symptomatic infections can also lower the proportion of asymptomatic infections. For example, a CDC report found that asymptomatic individuals identified through PCR testing developed symptoms a week later, and those individuals were reclassified as having been pre-symptomatic at the time of testing. Now, there's a lot of information coming out right now that's relevant to this, but I'm going to maybe cover the next day more about the PCR testing, more about the idea of the pre-symptomatic, asymptomatic. There's a huge study that just came out on the National Science Library, the NIH Library of Science, where they post all these studies. There's a huge one out today, as I just saw it, that is discussing the fact that 455 people who were asymptomatic, and that's important, so it's only asymptomatic, not showing symptoms, or excuse me, 455 people were introduced to an asymptomatic person or people with close contact, enough to, arguably get them sick based on what we know, and all 455 of them came back with no diagnosable anything in regard to transmission. And that is huge, of course, because the whole asymptomatic discussion is what they use right now to justify damn near everything. That we don't know who could have it, right? Well, that's a big deal. But again, I'll get to that more because this is what we're focusing on. But nonetheless, this stuff is incredibly interesting. Now, it says in figure 1-4, I may actually be skipping this part. Oh, actually, no, I wanted to get here. In figure 1, four cases grouped, and you have a group here you can see, illustration. Four cases grouped in the dotted line box are also included among seven infections, illustrating that all cases are infections, but not all infections are cases like the RT article was discussing. A potential point of confusion in media reports, right, again, that this was a confusion. That nobody from any walk of any expertise was able to point this out during this whole eight-month process, right? For example, a high number of coronavirus infections were discovered in U.S. meatpacking plants in Iowa, but these infections were reported as cases in the media, potentially causing a type of information bias known as misclassification. And this is incredibly important. Misclassification refers to the erroneous classification of an individual, a value, or an attribute into a category other than that to which it should be assigned. This type of information bias in epidemiological research can lead to underestimates or overestimates of associated disease and mortality risks. And here's the graphic for people to see. If you want to stare at it for a while, just pause the video. Now it says down here, the same information we were reading off. Now it says CFRs and IFRs represent different segments of a targeted population and contain widely different proportions of non-fatal infections. Therefore, misapplying findings or generalizing inferences between these two groups can cause a type of selection bias known as sampling bias or ascertainment bias. I mean, what type of bias don't our media exude today? It's ridiculous. In this type of bias, people who do not represent segments of the population to whom findings apply. Furthermore, quote, comparisons of the CFR of one disease with the IFR of another are mostly useless, end quote. And sampling bias can lead to serious inaccuracies, as when Congress was informed that the coronavirus is 10 times more lethal than in seasonal influenza, basically implying based off the rest of the stuff that we're going to talk about and what you've already seen, that that was the case, that this was incorrect, that this information being told to Congress was a miscalculation. That's where we are right now. And this is basically undeniable as far as anything I can tell you right now, as far as all of my research and everything I've looked into, and I've read this all the way over. not insert my opinion here, but this is powerful stuff. Now, jumping back here for a second to what this part was about. Enter the mad modelers of the lockdown. In the UK, the group I call the mad modelers of lockdown, the Imperial College experts, created the same panic, which we all remember this. On March 16th, they used an estimated IFR of 0.9% to predict that without lockdown, COVID would kill around 500,000 in the UK. Now, this is interesting. They add in this with the swine flu, which, by the way, we know is not what's happening. But it says with swine flu, remember that the IFR started at around 2%. At the end, it was 0.02%, which was five times lower than the lowest estimate during the outbreak. The more you test, the lower the IFR will fall. Now, think about that. And we knew this back then. We knew it in the beginning, the 70s version. We knew it in the 2000s version, the early. I mean, we just talked about all of these. The swine flu has been used more than once, and they've been caught lying about this more than once. And here we are, letting it all happen again. It's quite incredible. I mean, sure, we could pretend this was mistakes, and it might have been. But it seems kind of hard to miss how many times we've been in this position. Now it says, and this relates to what we were just reading, yes, we are testing and testing and finding more so-called cases, as you will. But the hospitals and the ICUs are virtually empty. Almost no one is dying of COVID anymore. And most of those who do were otherwise very ill. Instead of celebrating that, we've artificially created a whole new thing to scare ourselves with. We now call a positive test a COVID, quote, case. This is not medicine. A quote, case is someone who has symptoms. A case is not someone carrying tiny amounts of virus in their nose. Now, however, you test positive and you're a case. Never in history has medical terminology been so badly mangled. Never have statistics been so badly mangled. How in the world is this being allowed to happen? Like on such a tangible, obvious level where these things are being manipulated. Basic things like terminology use. Where are all the doctors? Oh, that's right. They're being censored when they speak up. You know, that's what's happening right now. That this is so obvious. It says, but we panicked and we added hugely to the toll, which is, we know what happened. The actions caused where we are right now. In the government actions is the point. Now it says, Congress was informed the coronavirus is 10 times as we were just reading. A comparison of coronavirus and seasonal influenza, CFRs, may have been intended during congressional testimony, but due to misclassifying an infection fatality rate as a case fatality rate, the comparison turned out to be between an adjusted coronavirus CFR of 1%, and an influenza IFR of 0.1%. And again, that's based on the assumption that this was a misclassification and not an intentional diagnosis in the correct word there, but an intentional misrepresentation. Making sure that this went away that would drive to the situation that has been created, which is now being used to justify the technocratic reimagination of our world. Yeah, there's no profit motive there at all. No incredible, a million different motives that we could get into. It says, had the adjusted coronavirus mortality rate not been lowered from 3% to 1%, fatality comparisons of the coronavirus to the IFR of seasonal influenza would have increased from 10 times higher to 20 to 30 times higher. By then, epidemiologists might have been alerted to the possibility of a miscalculation in such an alarming estimation. Now over to mitigation measures. It says, as the campaign to mitigate coronavirus transmission was implemented from March into May 2020, expected coronavirus mortality totals in the United States appeared much lower than the overestimation reported in congressional testimony on March 11th. And this is where you need to begin to ask yourself, why did people not begin to go, hey, wait a minute, right? This is at a time where, I mean, imagine how much more damage has been done since then until now, even though it was catastrophic then. If they would have been like, wait a minute, something's wrong. And the point is no one did. And that's not without them being aware that there was a discrepancy. Now it says, compared to the most recent season of influenza, severe influenza A, H3N2, in 2017-2018, with 800,000 U.S. deaths reported by CDC officials, 80,000 U.S. deaths reported by CDC officials, U.S. coronavirus mortality totals had just reached 80,000 on May 9, 2020. By then, relative to the 2017-18 influenza, it was clear that the coronavirus mortality total for the season would be nowhere near 800,000 deaths, inferred from the tenfold mortality estimation, overestimation reported to Congress. Now, even after adjusting for the effect of successful mitigation measures, now it's an important argument, that may have slowed down the rate of coronavirus transmission, it seems, according to Cambridge, unlikely that so many deaths were completely eliminated by a non-pharmaceutical intervention like social distancing, which was only intended to contain infection transmission, not suppress infections and related fatalities. And I find it a glaring, deafening absence of the pointing to masks in this entire, you'll notice. I think there's a reason for that, because social distancing is the only thing that's been scientifically shown to actually have an effect in regard to these things, other, you know, outside of hand washing, which they're not including. But after adjusting for the effect, and this is what the argument might be, that, well, the only reason it didn't get so bad is because of the mitigation measures. But this study goes on to point out and show you, based on the information, that that's, according to them, simply not the case. That in fact, caused far more damage. Now, it says also in early May 2020, just make sure I didn't miss that part, a New York State survey of 1,269 COVID-19 patients recently admitted to 113 hospitals found that most of the patients had been following shelter-in-place orders for 6 weeks, which raised state officials' suspicions about social distancing effectiveness. Still, polls showed that public credited social distancing and other mitigated measures for reducing predicted COVID-19 deaths and for keeping people safe from the coronavirus. It says, surprisingly, disproportionate mortality increases in Italian and American healthcare facilities during the height of the COVID-19 outbreak were not unique. Similar healthcare facility crises occurred during the 2016-2017 influenza season in Italy and during the 17-18 influenza season in the United States. Yet, shockingly, these earlier outbreaks did not appear to receive the same intensive media coverage as COVID-19. I wonder why. That's a huge point. Why not? Right? There's an obvious overlap here, but yet this is a hype, and that's what the point even Cambridge is pointing out. Although media reports of new coronavirus infections reinforced the public's belief that the virus was continuing to spread, greater levels of testing may have increased detection of infections that were already prevalent throughout the population. Where have we heard that before? I don't know, the entire independent media that's calling this thing right for quite a while now? I mean, it's incredible that this can be discussed. This would have been censored a few weeks ago if it was discussed on YouTube. It says, in addition, the accuracy of coronavirus tests rushed into production during the pandemic were unknown. Yeah, exactly. I would argue that they were unknown, and to a degree that was exactly why they were chosen, because of the relevance of the false positive, the prevalence, that they know that it was there. Now it says, PCR testing, they even note this in the study, has been in use since the detection of the H5N1 influenza virus in 2005. But a serious limitation of PCR testing is that nucleic acid detection is not capable of determining the difference between infective and non-infective viruses. Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly what we've been saying, and that's exactly why there's a huge asterisk next to all of this. Now, and I think that's the point. Now, it says, moreover, the CDC modified criteria to record coronavirus mortality by including, quote, probable and, quote, likely deaths in the International Classification of Disease Code for COVID-19. Yeah, we know that, too. And the point is, all of these things combined with probably six other things we could talk about in regard to the numbers, other asterisks and caveats here, that at the end of the day, they, all these things, one of these should be enough to say, hey, you can't use those to arrest somebody. You can't use those to force things on people because clearly they're not accurate, but here we are. And that's incredible. But there's a reason for that, in my opinion. Now make sure I want to make sure I didn't miss another part here. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, there's so much in here that we could go through, but I want to make sure I didn't miss the part that I had highlighted. Well, anyway, we'll start here because there was a section here in regard to, we were just reading mitigating effects. I mean, it's important stuff here, right? I mean, again, the end of the day, you guys should be reading this entire thing. I mean, this is very, very important to the development of this story. See where we were here on this one. Either way, we'll jump over here and we'll start off and we're going to keep going on fear and collateral damage. Because we were just talking about this on the last show. Psychological adverse effects such as anxiety, anger, and post-traumatic stress have been linked to restrictive public health mitigation measures due to isolation, frustration, financial loss, and fear of infection. A June 8, 2020 survey of the Association of Canadian Studies found that fear of contracting the coronavirus affected 51% of Canadians and 56% of U.S. Venturing out into public during the reopening phase was stressful to 50% of Canadians and 56% of Americans. And the second wave of the virus was also expected by 76% of Canadians and 64% of Americans. Furthermore, the possibility exists that yet another novel virus could emerge, potentially reigniting a perpetual process of unfounded fear and unnecessary lockdowns if mortality estimations are not properly vetted. I mean, that's a straight up, that is very clear. The bottom line is that regardless of what our perceptions were, that because we have other things that may circulate back around, that could lead to a perpetual, endless biosecurity state, creating fear and unnecessary lockdowns based on things that aren't really there. That's what it's saying here. It says fear in contrast to moral, civic duty, and political orientation. So make sure I read that correctly. Fear, in contrast to moral, civic duty, and political orientation, was shown to be a more powerful predictor of compliance with mitigation behavior in response to a viral pandemic. I mean, this needs to be ringing true in your mind right now with the parasite stress theory. Fear, in contrast to moral, civic duty, and political orientation, was shown to be a more powerful predictor of compliance with mitigating behavior and response to a viral pandemic, but with decreasing well-being and poorer decision-making. Isn't that just spot on? Studies have shown that fear impairs performance of cognitive tasks through debilitating anxiety and worry, which is affecting the whole planet right now. That's healthy, right? Even if a threat ceases to exist. Where have we heard that before? Prolonged fearful avoidance of threats is maladaptive and restricts to a return to normal social interaction and productivity. For example, after the outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, has ended in 2004, avoidance behavior continued to restrict people's social interactions and prevent people from returning to work. Now, think about that. So this is something that was recognized by governments, and this rings true with the parasite stress theory. That they're recognizing, okay, well, we need this to be a perpetual status, and people will fall into line. Now, that's my perception. Now, it says exaggerated levels of fear were driven by sense. This is coming from Cambridge. And to be clear, this is Cambridge University Press. Now, it says, exaggerated levels of fear were driven by sensationalist media coverage during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it cites three different citations all this stuff is cited at the bottom. And yet, while the public was ordered to lock down, Overall costs and benefits to society from severe mitigation measures had not been assessed. That will go down forever. People need to be held accountable for that. Like, you can't just claim you were doing what you thought was best for us. I mean, that does not fly in the face of the actions that we're seeing happen today. It says fear of infection also prevented people from seeking needed healthcare services in hospitals during the pandemic. The ethics of implementing fear-based public health campaigns needs to be reevaluated, as if that ever should have been something that they thought was okay, to basically either lie or use hyped fear to get you in place because that's your best interest. Sounds sort of like the lying for their truth or the, you know, Smith Modernization Act. So they can just say, oh, we're lying to you for national security, right? I mean, this is the kind of nonsense that we get pumped full of today, and that the blue checks can't stop talking about their moral righteousness and their altruism. It's not. And you're mindlessly pandering to an authoritarian state. That's what's happening right now. I was going to say oligarchy, but yeah, authoritarian is much more spot on. It says the ethics of implementing fear-based public health campaigns needs to be reevaluated for the potential harm these strategies can cause. Obviously, dissemination of vital health information to the public should employ emotionally persuasive messaging without exploiting and encouraging overreactions based on fear. You know, like give them information that they need to understand and then allow them to make decisions for themselves. Oh, that's incredible. In addition, legal and ethical violations associated with mitigation of pandemic diseases were previously investigated by Institutes of Medicine in 2007. So they've already investigated this exact situation. Legal and ethical violations associated with acting as if you're mitigating a pandemic. It says people, or, you know, doing so and then making these mistakes by accident, people should have the right to full disclosure of all information pertinent to adverse impacts of mitigation measures during a pandemic, including information on legal and constitutional human rights issues, and the public should be guaranteed a voice in a transparent process as authorities establish public health policy. Exactly. And guess what they've been doing instead? Censoring anybody who challenges the narrative. People like us, or even actual doctors that speak up and go, hey, here's a big problem. We have science that shows that lockdowns cause this. And, oh, World Health Organization challenges that. You're deleted. You're censored. And guess what? They were correct. And this is correct. This is stuff that's been very clear for a while, and yet they just hide it from you and force it on you. How in the world can that seem normal, and how can that seem associated in any way with the concept of freedom and liberty and democracy? Now, it says, lastly, or people should have the right... Yeah, we read that part. Lastly, severe mitigating measures during the COVID-19 pandemic caused considerable global social and economic disruption. I think that's pretty obvious to everybody. Enforced lockdowns, and the point should be ringing in your mind right now, based on something that wasn't really what we were told, period. Slam dunk. That's where we are right now. Enforced lockdowns, increased domestic violence, closed businesses and schools, laid off workers, restricted travel, affected capital markets, threatened the security of low-income families, and saddled governments with massive debt. Between February and April 2020, and when they say that, that really means you, because you are the one that's saddled with that debt. February and April 2020, U.S. unemployment rose from 3.5 to the lowest in 50 years to 14.7%. A recession in the United States was also officially declared in June 2020 by the National Bureau of Economic Research, ending 128 months of historic economic expansion, or, you know, based on the obviously misrepresented numbers that are always misrepresented from Bush to Obama to anybody else you want to talk about. They lie about that stuff, but, you know, partisan argument, go. But it says, of relevance, economic downturns are associated with higher suicide rates compared to times of prosperity. Obviously, we're seeing that now. An increased suicide risk may be associated with economic stress as a consequence of severe mitigation measures during a pandemic. Relapses and newly diagnosed cases of alcohol use disorder were also predicted to increase due to social isolation, and harmful drinking in China increased twofold following the COVID-19 outbreak. As a global natural experiment, psychological outcomes from restrictive interventions in COVID-19 pandemic require further investigations. Duh. I mean, this is just incredible. I'm glad they're saying this stuff, but it's like, I wish they would just put an exclamation mark there and be like, this is obviously wrong. This is another great graph, their image that we should be pointing to here. You know, just kind of showing this basic breakdown, the flow of information. Now it says, Public health lessons learned during the COVID-19 pandemic contribute knowledge and insights that can be applied to further. I mean, this is how they usually kind of finish these things. Oh, we should use this to apply to future. And if they don't want to, they never do. Just like every other mass study they did that comes to the conclusion that there's not a statistically significant, you know, difference in transmission. And then they go, we need more studies. And they just kick it down the line and they don't ever really come to a conclusion. But it says failure to intervene at the source of the problem. That's important. At the upstream levels of information bias and sampling bias can allow fear to rapidly escalate and may cause an overactive response that produces severely harmful collateral damage to society. That's the sentence in which we're living right now. Conclusion. Sampling bias in coronavirus mortality calculations led to, not maybe did, possibly did, our assumption is that it did. We think that it did. Nope. That these mortality calculations led to a tenfold increase mortality overestimation in March 11, 2020 U.S. congressional testimony. Period. This bias was likely followed from information bias due to misclassifying a, this is what we already read in the abstract, misclassifying a seasonal influenza infection fatality rate as a case fatality rate. Evident in a New England Journal of Medicine.org editorial. Evidence from the World Health Organization confirmed that the approximate case fatality rate of the coronavirus is generally no higher than that of the seasonal influenza. Yeah, that thing that we were saying from the beginning that they ultimately shouted you down for and said you were crazy, put your mask on, we're all going to die, blah, blah, blah. And arguably, we're finding out that it's far, far lower than that now, too, but let's just stick with what we're talking about. By early May 2020, mortality levels from COVID-19 were considerably below predicted overestimations, a result which the public attributed to successful mitigation measures. Not really. That's what, not the public. That's what the government told the public to think, not what the public actually thought, in my assessment. But it says the article presented important public health lessons, or this article, learned from COVID-19 pandemic. Reliable safeguards are needed in epidemiological research to prevent seemingly minor miscalculations, obviously not seemingly minor, like the same comparison discussing a satellite crashing into to Mars, just probably billions of dollars wasted by a small miscalculation. Similarly, we're seeing an incredible amount of people hurt by this in the same way for this minor miscalculation. But whatever, it says seemingly minor miscalculations from developing into disasters, which I believe that's what we're already into now. Sufficient organizational quality assurance procedures should be implemented in public health institutions to check, catch, and correct research biases and mistakes. I mean, the bias, that seems to suggest that's an intentional thing. Or I'm sure you can have subconscious biases, that's obvious, but I just cannot find, there's impossible for me to not see some complicity in this at some point. But it says that underestimate the or overestimate the associated risk. It says particularly the denominator of fatality rates should clearly define the group to whom fatalities apply. Public health campaigns based on fear can have harmful effects, and the ethics of such campaigns should be reevaluated. People need to have a greater voice in a transparent process that influences public health policy during an outbreak. And that's the exact opposite of what they will ever allow. And educational curricula should include basic research methods to teach people how to be better consumers of public health information. But at the end of the day, which that sentence is telling you, let them think for themselves. Let them research what they will and allow them to be smart enough to show discernment and come to their own conclusions. But I argue it's a dangerous sentence as well, because educational curricula should include basic research methods. You could find in there a social engineering possibility, here's a tool, here's an app that'll show you how to research, which could guide you in a day. But bottom line, it should be up to the individual. The public should also be fully informed of the adverse impacts on psychological well-being and how this can affect the economy and everything and all of us, that we should have been told, which they argued was not the case. The obvious point is that the solution, quote, solution is incredibly, catastrophically, obviously, waving red, or I think as Helen said, and the Beninsky said, a forest of red flags, obvious, wrong, catastrophic failure. Clearly, this action was the opposite of what they should have done. Now it says, in closing, nations across the globe may fearfully anticipate future waves of the coronavirus pandemic and look bleakly toward outbreaks of other novel viral infections with a return to severe mitigation measures. However, well-worn advice from a famous aphorism by the poet philosopher George Santana should be borne in mind, which is relevant to public health lessons learned in the article. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Obviously, that's probably one of the most relevant things, but this country, seemingly, and seemingly the world as it grows, has the attention span of a housefly. We can't think past what happened in yesterday's news, and that's not anybody's fault other than the aggressive social engineering of us by our government for a very long time. As Caitlin would say, we are the most propagandized population on the planet. But to finish off with the end of this article, as they point out, as the research made clear, but because we panicked, we added hugely to the toll. We locked down in fear. We killed tens of thousands unnecessarily in fear. We crippled the economy and left millions in fear of their livelihoods. We have trapped abused women and children at home with their abusers. We have wiped out scores of companies and crushed entire industries. Obviously, there's a bunch more examples they list that you should read. Lockdown can be seen as a complete and utter disaster. And it was all based on a nonsense, a claim that COVID was going to kill 1%, which we know was a, quote, mistake. Sweden did not lock down, and it has a death rate of 0.0058%. Let's end this ridiculous nonsense now. Seems like an obvious, no-brainer of a conclusion. But since this was published on August 12th, and they're not even talking about it, seems to suggest that they just hope you don't know it's there. Now, what does that really tell you about the big picture? Hopefully, you've come to that conclusion for yourself. Thank you for being here today. I'll see you tomorrow. I love you all. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
What if the experts are wrong? What if quarantining the healthy doesn't actually save lives? What if wearing a mask in public is not effective?
If you do not have a mask, you cannot ride public transportation, sir.
My name is Dr. Jeff Barkey, and I'm here representing thousands of physicians across the country whose voices are being silenced because we don't agree with the mainstream media and the experts who are telling us what to do.
Everything I've seen in the last 9 days, all the things that just don't make sense, the patients I'm seeing in front of me, the lungs I'm trying to improve, have led me to believe that COVID-19 is not this disease and that we are operating under a medical paradigm that is untrue.
Never in the history of this great republic have we quarantined the healthy. Never in the history of this great republic have we told churchgoers that it's illegal for you to exercise your First Amendment right of freedom of religion. Never in the history of this country have we been told that you can't go to church because it's not essential, but you can go get an abortion because that's essential. Never before in our country have we let criminals out of jail, but we've told you you can't exercise your Second Amendment right and protect yourself by purchasing a firearm. When liquor stores are deemed essential, but your businesses are deemed non-essential, there's something wrong going on.
We cut off people's utilities this week and made them pay what could have been their last check to us to turn their lights on in a global health pandemic. But you don't care about that. You didn't want to meet.
This booklet, the Declaration of Independence and our U.S. Constitution, was never designed to restrain the people. It was designed to restrain the government. We're realizing that the fatality rate of this virus is in the ballpark of a bad seasonal influenza. Do not let your voices be silenced. We will see eventually that this government-imposed cure is going to be worse than the virus itself.
You're choking me, bro. Stop. Help! Stop. Help, man. This shit ain't right, bro.
Stop.
This shit ain't right.
But what's happening now as unemployment reaches 20 to 30 million people is those folks are now becoming dependent on the government. And what government dependency causes is a larger, more tyrannical government.
Look. He ain't even do nothing.
We the people want to put our government back in its place. We want a small representative government, not a large tyrannical government. I'm here representing thousands of physicians around the country whose voices must be heard.
We've never seen where we quarantine the healthy, where you take those without disease and without symptoms and lock them in your home.
So you guys are asking me to leave the store for not wearing a mask when I have a medical condition, even though yours is pulled under your nose.
A note that says
I don't have to bring a note, and yours isn't even on.
You can do whatever you want to do.
It's America, right?
Listen.
I cannot wear a mask.
Get out.
Do not let your voices be silenced.